and who we think by speaking to about the sorts of things that we, the arts council, are interested in, we will be able to give some great information which otherwise might just be lost to history. Mr. Chalk, what I specifically would like to ask you to begin with is about your earliest awareness of the kinds of work that has been done in the county. I realize that you're one of the few people, thank heaven, who cares about what is being done in the arts. But as a small group, where you really is that Edward Redfield lived in the outskirts of New Hope and the sorts of things that he and some of his friends were doing?
Yes. Ever since I can remember, ever since I could read, I was conscious, and also because of my parents, only conscious of the artist colony in New Hope. And we used to go over and see the art shows at Phillips Mill. And my father and mother would bring us to Goyle and to Farm Hill and the Mercer Museum. And when I was in college, every time I had company, I was a classmate or a company, I would bring them to Goylestown to see Farm Hill and the Historical Society building, because I didn't want them years later to say, oh yes, I've been to Doylestown, and then somebody would say, well, did you see Farm Hill, or did you see the Mercer Museum, and they'd say, no, I didn't see it. And then, as a little extra bonus, we would take them down to see it, to see the working cathedral.
Well,
how far was that along with that here? I guess it's like a relatively recent. No, the exterior, it's sort of like a cathedral thing under the bomb. It never done.
Right.
But I mean, the exterior was done by that time. Now I'm talking about when I was in college, which was in the 20s, in the late 20s. I graduated in 1929.
Well, one thing I'd love to know, this year will be the 47th annual exhibition at Phillips Mill, so obviously that we have been going on for a very long while. Was there a Republican awareness of it then, or do you think you were just lucky that your parents happened to know about and hear about this year?
No, I think there was an awareness. I think there wasn't the, I don't like to use the word, but I'll use it, the commercial awareness. You know, New Hope, before it became Greenwich Village, and the same goes for Provincetown, was a nice, quaint, charming little town. And you know, if you drove through New Hope, you'd see artists, men and women, maybe painting in the fields, or painting in beside the building, or painting in a woodland, or something like that. And they were accepted just as a part of the community. They weren't pointed out, you know, like a sideshow or a freak. Because in the first place, you take all those artists that settle there, like the Lace Rocks and the Fallen Trees and the Garbers and all those, they all took a part in the community. They were interested in the community life.
Well, I think those that are left to go here, I mean, Mrs. Fallen Tree is a member of Royal Council.
Yes, she was.
Woman.
Yes, she was.
Yes, she was. Well, it was my understanding that those first exhibitions at the Mill were almost through the artists themselves, that each of them kind of gathered their work and they just kind of had a show.
I think they had them only, but didn't they only have them like in the spring, I think, or the fall?
Well, when I was a young teenager, they had them in the spring.
Yes, that as I remember.
Which they haven't, because it gave you two opportunities to show your work.
I remember, well, I was out of the college at UC in 1929, and I remember as I got a job at the Intelligencer for $15 a week, and I would entertain some of my friends, and I would always manage, we would go to Phillips Mill in the afternoon, but I would always have them during the time that the art exhibit was on, so they could see that.
And you can do a part of that?
Then I'd bring them back to Doylestown, and we'd have dinner.
Well, were there prizes, that kind of thing
that
there is now, or
yes, that yes, yes, yes. No, what I meant by commercial was, it wasn't that high pressure business about selling, like, you mean, yes, in New Hope, there weren't all those shops, you know, and all that. See, that came much later. That came, I think, all that crass commercialism, I think, came after the World War II. Went because you take before World War too, if you take back around 1937, 1938, 39, along there, you must remember there wasn't one nice restaurant in Europe. All they had was maybe just a little joint. There was no place to sleep between, like, there was no place to sleep in New Hope in those days. And there was no place to sleep between New Hope and, say, Morristown, except Doylestown, with its hotel. Yes, there was no place to sleep between Doylestown and Philadelphia. There were no, Willow Grove in those days, before the naval station came and all that, was definitely after the war, were all they had there was a greasy spoon. They had no motels, no restaurants. And George Slaughter, who was the proprietor of the Fountain House, used to like to say that on one Saturday, during the Princeton football game season, he took in almost $1,000. And he was so sorry that he took in a little over $900 on one Saturday from people who stopped to eat to the game or coming home from the game and people who stayed overnight. Yes, it is. And of course, you can imagine those days, you know, what meals were, what they were, $1.25, $1.50, or $2 was regarded as a lot for a meal.
When I was doing sandwiches, I never did have a pizza. But when this other than a place where we went to the traffic streets and have something to eat.
Oh, yes.
Culturally, we're in it, or just with Dr. Mercer's group, a learning view and have. You know, we're pushing his thing, which is more of a historical and archaeological rather than.
Yes, he was alone in his own field, and he wanted to be alone. He didn't like people barging out there and barging in on his. And Mrs. Swain sandwiched the guests in between so that it wouldn't bother Dr. Mercer. And if she saw him in a room, she quietly tiptoed and closed the door. And then she came out.
Well, you mentioned him in the country.
Yes.
So this is all he did for a while.
Oh, yes. Yes. What I always did was call up and ask. Because I thought that was the only polite thing to do, and ask her what time, and then she would set the time. And then there was no admission, and what do you call it?
Oh, even then?
Yeah.
She
never knew. Yeah.
Talking about the
travelers
for that, was that was then a going operation?
That is how it was? Yes. You never had anyone there.
Oh, you did?
No. They never took anybody in there. They only took you through Fort Hill, and they took you in that little, what was like a barn or something. You know, it has the meeting room upstairs with the fireplace, you know, that lovely room upstairs. Yeah, or call it the carriage house. That's where he lived, that home is where they took you. And of course, Mrs. Swain used to tell me, told me that, like, Dr. Mercer, excuse me, one time a bulletin reporter, a woman, came to interview him, and he was wearing a skull cap. And wouldn't you know, she was fool enough to center her article on the skull cap. That did it.
You know,
from then on, women reporters were out. That did it.
Yes, like Dr.
Moore. Yes, yes, exactly. But, we have relatives or friends like from Bethlehem or Allentown, and they had never heard of Fort Hill, but Dr. Mercer does that. And they couldn't believe it when you bring them down here and show them what it had and what was in it.
Well, this is what I think you all do not know when you do, and it's completely sure these things with it.
Well,
because the public awareness is even just now becoming, it's certainly because the fact that Mercer is here has got to have some kind of maintain it.
And I think I dare say I'll bet were loads of people from Doyle that never were inside of the Mercer Museum or Haunted. They probably went to Mount Vernon, saw Mount Vernon or the Harrisburg, or maybe saw the Statue of Liberty. But it's that business of diamonds in your own backyard, you don't bother to go see that.
But in a sense, something that encouraged it because you just didn't want to be bothered. Maybe he was being scholarly and doing it.
Yeah.
Did he see archaeologists and ceramicists and people that weren't interested in the
much more willing.
I think Jim Michener put it nicely. When Jim Michener was a small boy and lived in a house almost across the street from Park Hill, it's sort of hidden, it used to be hidden with a very high fence, you know, shrubbery. And he said, in all, when he was growing up and he saw Dr. Mercer, he said he never once spoke to him. Because he said Dr. Mercer knew he couldn't learn anything from a child.
Oh, right.
I think that's wonderful.
He was an efficient
guy. So,
well, tell me which of the Peters of the Central New Hope School can you tell us something about? Did you know George Stoddard? Did you know Daniel Burke?
I knew George Stoddard. He used to take an interest in the Doylestown Theater Guild. I did not know. I knew Mr. Follins, who he talked to, and I knew Mr. Redfield, which is very happy to be with him. And well, I knew William Francis Taylor. Yes, and you know what a sharp tongue he had, Dr. Melfi.
Well, I think he's sort of interested in about his father and Redfield, especially because of their interest in Dr. Charles Bailey. Enthusiasm for the arts in the school that we instituted throughout the county and sort of from the Upper County Public School Collection, which I think is another thing in which the county is not aware of what they have. And apparently Dr. Bain, you know, through the friendship that he had with Walter Anderson Gordon, you must have known.
Yes, I know him. Yes, I know him. I don't know how that came about. Was Dr. Bain responsible for that? I guess he was.
Well, we spoke to him, and unfortunately, definitely not at the paper center.
Yes.
We should do that.
Yes.
He was telling us that it was George's friendship with George Stoddard, particularly, I think, and Robert Emerson Bourne, who was a painter, a teacher, and a newspaper critic.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea just was formulated for having art in the public schools so the children would know what was here in the county, what was being done.
And that was that traveling art.
I remember
I used to see them, like in the school building in Doylestown, Jones, and later Central Park, you know. I mean, it's nice to meet paintings, you know, see by red school. I mean, I used to, I was a little fearful. Because I thought maybe something would happen to them.
Well, I think this is why you're not seeing them so much today.
Yes,
They are put in typical positions so they aren't harmed to be able to lie to them. But that's not the purpose of having them.
No, I know.
So, you know, I think there's got to be something here that will review the whole bit so that they can do that. We're having an exhibition that you may or may not have seen right now in the Drury Lab. Of a portion of that
Park.
What do you remember about George Stoddard particularly? Because I don't know much about him, but he seemed to be
You mean George Stoddard?
Yes.
He was a very quiet, soft-spoken man. And you would never, he was not what you would you think of as an artist. He might have sold real estate or done anything else. I mean, there was nothing artsy about it. But, you know, he was in the same class that Oscar Hammerstein was. You know, if there was one person that did not look like he was in show business, it was Oscar Hammerstein. He never wore flashy clothing, you know, or he wasn't the epitome of the latest thing that was going on Broadway or something like that. He just dressed very quietly, very conservatively, and until you spoke to him, you would have no idea that he knew about the theater the way he did.
How about Redfield? I mean, he was recognized.
Well, I didn't know much about him. He was older, and he was more like a paternal type, but you know, but he was always making something, you know, with his hands. He was very clever at making all kinds of things, you know, as well as painting.
Well, I knew he didn't cut frogs and
yes, things like that. Yeah, and make things, don't you know? But one thing that I cherish about Redfield was when I was going back to the early 1930s,
my class, probably earning $18 a week or something like that, intelligence. And I took a vacation, and as a vacation, I took a bus trip to Chicago. And because I didn't have much money, I rode like straight through. And of course, you know, in those days, the buses had bus stops, you know, they didn't have toilets on the buses like they do now. They had these bus stops.
Well, you know, that could be agonizing, you know, because it's like when you leave Philadelphia and you know you can't go to the toilet. By the time you get out of the boulevard and see a drove up, you've got to go to the toilet. So it could be agonizing. And by the time I got to Chicago, I was in agony. And so I said to the bus driver, I said, there's something wrong with me. I said, I can't go to the toilet. He said, how long have you been riding? And I said, well, I've been riding 3 or 4 nights or whatever it was, 3 or 4 days. And he said, well, if you don't have to go pretty soon, can't we? You better see a doctor. Well, everything turned out all right. But I went to the Chicago Art Museum, and I was walking through it, and I walked into a room, and a big room, and on the wall was just one painting. That was a red field painting, and it was a scene, oh, immense, and that was a scene of, like when you approach New Hope, you know, when you go towards New York, the way you see the river and the hills and of Lambertville, and the part of the New Hope in the foreground, and you know, just simultaneously, you know, you just holler, that's Bacchanalia, because nobody hears you, you know, nobody says yes, nobody says no, but it just made you glow. It made you feel so at home, and it made you feel so wonderful.
Well, anything that is this true, and this can happen in some of the person.
Yes.
And it's so exciting, and this is why I guess I've also dedicated the Arts Council. Maybe we can make everybody this year,
yes,
this excited about, really, the Heritage.
I don't know. Are you familiar at all with the works of Maximilian Bacon?
Oh, sir.
Okay, well, I know him very well.
Oh, he was a hero.
And you know, he owned that so much yellow. Remember that it was a different shade of yellow each time. But you know, you could almost go anywhere and say that's Becker. You know, because of
okay.
And of course, you know what he did with the birds.
Oh, well, I know he had one of them in his pocket.
Yeah, they sat on his shoulder and they sat on his ear. They came in the window in the morning and when he was asleep, they sat on the pillow and pecked at his nose or his ear and woke him up. And he always reminded me a little bit. He had a gentleness, you know, that reminded me a little bit. I never knew him, but St. Francis of Assisi, I guess, or something like that. There was something almost.
Well, he was in the heat and.
Yeah.
I liked it.
I haven't thought about it,
but he didn't rush one,
the Latin
era.
Yeah, he was a little later, you know, than the early ones of the. And then of course there were some of those women, you know, that were wonderful to be early. What was it? Elizabeth Price wasn't a Fern College, you know, some of those, you know. But New Hope in those days, what I know, you can't go back, you can't change it. But it was so different, you know, it was a nice, quiet little it really was a little artistic village, don't you know?
Well, did many of them really get the tip over? Did they
Oh, they lived all around. They lived all around.
The environments rather than that.
They lived all around, yeah.
Do you remember Louis Day, or did you ever know?
No.
How about Lee Gatch? They're kind of the rebels.
No, but then, you know, later on, a new school came in, what we called modernistic in those days.
Well, they were very avant-garde. They certainly made their mark in that.
Then, of course, I think one of the most bizarre and interesting characters among the artists was that, what was his name? Lived up along the river road. And you know, he got so annoyed because people stole his flowers. And the wildlife, the ferns, you know, and all that. But you know, then he set traps that which were guns that would go off.
Oh dear heaven.
Yes, he did, to shoot people. And
what did his painting
do? He got killed by his own gun.
Oh,
he got got killed, three were found, that he had one that was loaded and had disengaged, and he did something and went off and killed him. Do you know my name? Somewhere up there now? He did somewhere around there, like right along the river road, somewhere.
Well, I'm at
the river. Yes, somewhere in there.
Just down from us.
And I just can't think of anything, but
I can't think of anything. Well, I never heard that.
He got killed by his own.
What sort of painting did he do?
I don't know.
Able come to.
He was one of the minor ones, I think, wasn't he?
I think
not. Yeah. I don't think he was in the class with Garber or with Follinsby or later on, you know, or something.
Well, did it ever occur to you? I've always been just absolutely astounded that someone who was as physically disabled as John Follinsby could be so much bigger. Yes, Jerry. Quite great personality, managed so well. Tell me, I have another name that I know very little about, who did have a meeting in this exhibition. It was terribly good. Elmer Schofield, did you know that?
No.
Well, the Bucks County School apparently several of his paintings are their own really enormous.
No.
How about Kenneth Nonick?
No.
Sure.
We can't have everybody else in our do too. Well, Lee Ross. Lee Ross. Oh. Lee Ross. Yes, I knew him to say how do you do to it. And Mrs. Lee Ross called me when Mr. Follinsby died and asked me not to mention it in the write-up, in the obituary.
Oh, bless her.
She said that I think she and her husband were at the were the like the best man and the maid of honor or maid of honor or something like that, the Follinsby's wedding. And she said, please don't mention that he's handicapped, you know, and a victim of polio, you know.
But you never really instantly, never remember about him because he was such a vital and
gracious
kind of guy.
Yeah. See,
and
I'm
trying to look at his painting.
Yeah.
Never suspected.
Like at the opening of the playhouse, you know, he was there in his wheelchair, don't you know?
Well, and he was always in the mill and had all the nose how, you know, it was very
difficult. Yeah. I tell you an experience, if I may, that Mrs. Follinsby and I had. Black people now. I just hardly bring myself to say it because my mother would have slapped me across the mouth when I said black people when I was growing up. You know, she said colored people, you know, or Negroes. The Negroes here in Doylestown, remember a colored family moved to Levittown. Remember that bus they had? Yeah, all right. The colored people here in Doylestown got Mrs. Follinsby and me to go down to Levittown to a meeting. We met at a private home and to see, you know, what we could do and how we could help mitigate it and handle it and so forth. Well, both of us got sent back. We were the only two white people there, and both of us got sent back. When what they wanted to do, they wanted there was some chicanery that they were going to use. Like white people would buy it and then give it to, you know, like a straw thing, to the black people. She neither she nor I go for that. I mean, we wanted to say these are black people and they want to buy this place and they want to move in, because we both said that's being just as crooked and devious and dishonest as the white people who hate them. So that sort of ended that. Because they didn't like it, and we didn't play along with them, don't you know?
Well, how did you and Mrs. Follinsby happen to be the two who bring us
to go? I don't know. It was a Nelson here from Doylestown.
Oh, okay. Well,
the Nelsons that got me, see? And how they got her, I don't know.
But they were such respected members of the culture.
And of course, you you know, the irony was, you know, the Nelsons had had a colored barbershop here in Doylestown, which the irony was that colored people did not get their hair cut in the daytime. They could only go there at night in the shade of the pool. Oh, I'm glad that era is gone. I'm glad that's over. They'd have had firebombs if they were in business today. They'd have been firebombs. You know that.
Well, it's too big.
Yes. See, but that's the way it was. They knew what they were doing. They knew they positively would not get. And they had the finest, I hate to use the word, but the finest white customers here in Doylestown, like Arthur East Burns, you know, Charles Radcliffe, the bankers. But you see, that no colored people went in there while those people were in there. That they come and people have to come at night. And I'll tell you, the bitter experience that I had with Randall Nelson, he took me to Philadelphia to hear Dr. Martin Luther King. So I thought, well, coming home, I'll leave it up to him. He'll know where to stop, you know, to get something to eat. So I said, Randall, I live in Philadelphia. Where do you want to stop to get something to eat? So he picked, of all places, the Saddler at the Pennsylvania Railroad, there along in North Philadelphia. Well, when we got there, it was closed, the Savarin restaurant. And of course, you know, if you know anything about the Savarin restaurant, I was damn glad because they were horrible, remember? The food tastes like it's been cooked for a week, you know.
I think I was only ever in one
of these. Yeah, well, you know what that was like. You know, remember? Big wide counter, you know what it was like. And so we came out, and there was, used to be a diner, isn't there anymore, but there was a diner right across the street from North Philadelphia Station, and we went in there, and we sat down, and this smart, flippant, young, white counterman, don't you know, came up and slammed the glass of water only in front of me and said, boss, what will you have? And I said, to Randall, let's go.
Thank heavens, a lot of
that's wonderful. Yeah. Of course, I went through something, you know, when I was in college, it was like between 1925 and 29, and I went to the Bellevue one time, and one of the Indians, one of the Hindus, you know, the Indians of India went along with me, and, you know, we got to the door of the Bellevue, and they said, he can't come in here. He's from India, he's a Hindu. The times have changed.
Well, my cat.
Yes, actually, surely have. I mean, when you go to the theater now, isn't it wonderful? You see all these black people. What, years ago, you never saw anybody black people. It didn't make any difference how educated, how talented they were. They couldn't sit anywhere except you know where. And there was a reason for calling that awful name, you know. You know that second ballot? Yes. I think all I'm just trying to think of that artist's name. I'll write your card and send it to you.
Oh, we'll get on this gadget. Preserve it for all time. Tell me, we're how enormously the population of Bucks County has grown.
Oh.
And you're working as closely as you have, or not with before the newspaper. Do you think they're paying more or less attention to the kinds of cultural activities in the county now? I don't think they're paying enough, but then I don't think they were paying enough.
Yes,
I mean, you're aware?
I think so. Yeah. I think so for now. For instance, I was delighted when we had our office picking just the news room. Go up in Florence's, and we have a young part-time photographer from North Wales, and he came up to me and he said, I understand you know something about Dr. Mercer, and then he said, tell me about him. Now here's a young guy, you know, maybe only 18, 19 years old, and I said, how did you become interested in Dr. Mercer? And he said, well, I've been reading about him. So you see, I think
Oh, that was fabulous.
Wasn't that something, the way they did that?
Really?
Those two women, wasn't that yet? And of course, I remember years ago, maybe 10, 15 years ago, when Architectural Chicago came to the intelligence and wanted to go down to the museum. Because to this day, they do not understand how a man like Dr. Mercer, who after all was not an architect, could make that concrete stick and not fall down the way he did. And they said that what he must have known about stress and all that, you know, that an architect understands, and he must have picked up on his own. They just couldn't believe it.
If you're
up
there in
the
Tops.
Yeah.
It's just fascinating.
Yeah.
And
that didn't fall down. Now, that's 50 years.
Well, they said that the owner of the building was going to be worried about the fact that it might be fragile.
So, I mean, there were three or four. And they
Will you tell us what you remember about, was he Dr. Porter Emerson Waugh, or was he just plain Waugh?
I think Porter Emerson Waugh.
Okay. Well, I know he was.
Maybe it was doctor later on, I'm not sure.
Well, I don't know how we've ever had time to get his doctor
today. Yeah, his doctor.
Well, I know he lived in Allentown, or Sellers.
So he
had an art school in Allentown, didn't he?
Yes.
And he was instrumental in starting the Allentown. I only ever remember seeing him terribly old.
Yeah, I never knew him very well. No, only to me casually, you know. But he always impressed me as he was a very quiet, unassuming man, you know. He hardly ever talked about his work.
Oh, didn't he?
Well, not to me, you know. See, maybe into another artist, you know. See, but. I don't know. He wasn't exactly in the same school, was he?
Oh, no.
The heavyweights were.
Yeah.
Yes. See, he came along with his wonderful snow scenes, didn't he, in Pennsylvania Dutch scenes like Lightsville and Spinnertown and places like that, don't you know? See?
Another man that sort of is isolated in a sense because he didn't belong to any group was Walter Calvert. Did you know him? He did a lot of commercial things. He did gorgeous things.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
He lived here in Doylestown.
Right.
And I knew him, you know, to say hello to him, good morning to him, don't you, and ask him how are you, sort of. But I never knew what he did. I mean, I never knew that he did anything that was nice, you know, or anything.
Oh, well, I thought it was. That's one person's opinion.
You know so much more than I do.
Well, he did a lot of work for the Bell Telephone. Directory covers.
Yeah.
And some of them.
Yes, now I know.
The groundskeepers,
yeah.
House, the Willstown Cemetery. And then just some rather landscape-ish
looking things. There's another man that I used to like and meet so often and lives in Solbury. He was Forrest Crooks. Is it Forrest Crooks?
Well, I don't know. He's big in agriculture.
Yeah, he was an illustrator, didn't he? New illustrations? Yeah, I think he did. Illustrations. And
he's now a conservationist.
Yeah. And then, of course, you know, the Blue Eagle Man.
Oh, sure, Charlie Cleaner.
I liked him.
Wow, has he ever come along since the Blue Eagle Man?
I liked him. I interviewed him when soon after he moved here to Bucks County after he had done the Blue Eagle.
Oh, did you really?
Enjoy talking to him, no joke. And I've seen him every now and then. And of course, you know, he's gone in for writing. You know, he writes wonderful things like about fishing up in Canada and national life and things like that.
Well, I knew I.
Now, what was his name? I can't think.
Charles Coyner.
Oh, of course, Charles T. Coyner. Yes.
And he's been the.
You know, he was one of our oldest celebrities of the era that when Pearl Buck and those came. He's one of the oldest ones, and he's still here.
Well, bless his heart.
Yeah.
That's a good thing
yeah.
when he sees it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's true. We sort of had waves.
Oh, yes.
I mean, the New Hope School, really hardly any of them were native Bucks County, it's one of them. And then,
they all came like from far away and had either studied in France or something like that, don't you know?
Well, Charles Skinner and Paul Darrow, you know him.
Yeah.
Well, I think that they were all advertising and probably Walter Calvert belonged in that particular group and category too. There must have been an influx at one point of that kind of person. There was another man and his wife.
Dr. Rolfe Liddell.
Is he the one that went out with the
gun? He was the one who didn't commit suicide. But he carried conservation and what else do you call him? Conservation and ecology to the extreme. See, he got so infuriated when people would stop and pull up these vines, mountain pinks, all the wild things that grew along the river road between the canal and the river road and the side of the hill. That he contrived these different mechanisms, and then forgot, as I said, to enter this engage upon him and met his own death.
Okay.
It's not ironic. Dr. Ross, he's seen that. Yeah.
How about Ben Solomon?
Yes, he's in my old township, in my old
bedroom. Right.
Yeah. But you see, I was gone by that time. See, I came to Doylestown in 1929, you know, see, and he, see, I missed him. I missed the Philip and Julius Anside, the scenario writers. I missed Ruth and Augustus Getz. You know, they were Hollywood writers, and they wrote the play, The Heiress.
Did they get the
Bedminster
as well?
They did, above the Ridge Road, right above the Ridge Road in the Keller Church here.
Well, I suppose that even though people moved to the area, and you were a newspaper reporter, it would still be rather difficult to, you know, just go out and say, here I am.
It was difficult. Now this is the change in the times. It was difficult because God rest his soul, the editor we had at that time. When the artist would bring in something that they wanted in the paper, his argument was that you're buying space in the newspaper, all right? And you ought to pay for it. You ought to advertise. Because he said, when you go to the store, he said, Lester, and he said, you buy soap or you buy a wash rag. They don't give you one or the other. You know, they only sell you a wash rag or they sell you soap, don't you know? That was very provincial.
Well, this is what I was talking about before about the attitude, because it is somewhat better.
Oh,
and I think they've sort of taken some pride in the fact that
much better.
World War I wasn't a good
one. And you take before World War II, back in like in the mid-30s, the only thing the Philadelphia papers knew or cared about in Bucks County if there was some sensational murder or a crime. I remember a colored baby was found dead somewhere over around New Hope. And I phoned it in to the Philadelphia papers. And I didn't say it was black or it was colored. But some, you know how they have a way of asking when the reporter said, is this a nigger? What could I say? A few tears.
And that was the only time they
did. They didn't know anything about Bucks County in those days. Because it's like it is now, a household word, don't you know? Like it has become now. I remember one time driving down Broad Street in Philadelphia, and I tried hurry to get through the light. And then the cop came over and said, did you see the light? And I said, yes, but it was too late. He said, do you think you could see the station house if I took you there? I said, yes, sir. I know better than argue with cops. He said, let me see your license. So I gave him my license, and he said, Doyle Campbell. Oh, he said, you AC. You go back to your farm.
Oh, that was wonderful.
Not those days.
Well, you just said something that I think is kind of interesting. You said that Bucks County's now a household word. When do you feel that change took place?
When the columnists and the newspapers picked it up, like the New York columns, when all these celebrities began to move in from New York.
You're talking about George.
Yes, that crowd, the actors and the writers, see, the Spiewak, Sam and Bella Spiewak were one of the earliest people to move here, but you see, nobody cared about them. They worked in Hollywood, but nobody cared about them or gave them any publicity until they wrote the show Boy Meets Girl. See, then they became, and in that day, you see, that was the beginning of Cafe Society. See, then those were the blues, were the things they talked about, you know. And see, Bucks County, I remember going to New York in the 30s, and when I said, when I moved to Doylestown, Bucks County, they said, and the people were here in this heat, why didn't you stay up in the Poconos where it's nice and cool? I said, my God, man.
In New York? I said, Bucks County is this far from the Poconos. As it is from New York, see?
Well, I think, you know, it's such a strange situation that the county sort of does take pride in the fact that these people lived here, but those people were really just transients.
Yeah.
And there have been people who are really living here for a major portion of their life, busy and working and productive, that the county is pretty much ignored.
Pearl Buck was the one, of course, she was the love of my life, and she was the one. I think she was the first big name celebrity to come to Bucks County, and she took roots.
Yeah,
she certainly did. And she took roots because you know how she got her divorce the same time. She got her divorce from Dr. John Walsingbaum the same time that Mrs. Walsh got her divorce from John Richard Walsh. And so you can imagine the two wives both getting divorced simultaneously. Just imagine if we had television. Thank God we only had radio and newspaper. Tell her you were in love. My name is photographed in the bathtub. So Pearl Buck was enraged at the American press. See, when she moved here, like in 1935, she was enraged at the American press because she said in China, the Chinese pay no attention to the personal lives of anybody. They didn't at that time. Their leaders or their artists, their writers, or anybody. And so she said that was a part of American life that she did not know. So I wrote her a letter, and she refused. She told me how she refused every metropolitan newspaper person an interview because of that reason, because of the way the press had treated her. But she said she would see me because she regarded me as a neighbor. And I was the first person to interview her. And then she told me she poured out all this bitterness. Oh, and they did go through hell. See, they bought a place where a road, a little country road, dirt road, ran between the house and the barn. And mind you, people, of course, this was during the middle of the Depression, you know, people didn't have a lot to do. They would drive up there and peek in under the shades at night.
Oh, you're kidding!
And to see what the house looked like. Just imagine. And she came to court. She got Mark Thatcher, an attorney, and she came to court. And they went around and spoke to all the neighbors. It was wonderful that way. Spoke to all the neighbors whether she could have that road closed and a road built on the other side of the barn, so that the people at least couldn't go right between the house and the barn like they used to.
At least the people harder.
Yeah. And you know, she spoke in the high school in Perkins, in the old Perkins Dell High School. She spoke to them for the Perkins Women's Club because she said she regarded I regard you as my neighbor, and that's the reason she spoke. And she was delightful. Of course, she couldn't wear clothes in those days. She hadn't learned how to be chic or have any style. You know, it was the days of those hats. You're not old enough. It was the days of those three-quarter hats with big pheasant tails, feathers out the side. Remember? That was one old enough.
Well, no, the only time I ever saw her, she looked like the Talbot giraffe.
Yes, sure she did. But she acquired all that later. She acquired all that later. All her style and oh, you know how curious she could be, you know.
Right?
Quiet.
Scared of the daylights out of us.
Yeah. And then she spoke. The reason I'm telling you this is a woman a couple of weeks ago, Nora Sterling from New York, who was doing a biography, came to see me. And she put me on the recorder about Pearl Buck, don't you? And she said I was the first person that ever said she had a sense of humor and she couldn't get over it. And she said, now you've got to prove to me why you say Pearl Buck has a sense of humor. And I said, well, I can tell you why she has a sense of humor. I said, I've heard her speak so often. I said, she had a magnificent sense of humor. I said, it could be subtle. It could be biting. But it also could be very broad. And then I said, how she has spoken. They said, well, her college mates said she had no sense of humor. I said, well, I bet she was very unhappy in college. and she was unhappy in a lot of other places, I think. But when she came to Bucks County, see, this was her, the love of her life, Richard John Walsh, don't you know, see? And I say, how she got up to talk before these women first, and she talked about how the women in China wear pants, and how wonderful the pants are. They keep you warmer, and they're handier to dust, and they're handier to wash, and they're handier to do everything. Oh, you all sat there like dummies. We didn't know what she was talking about. Why, nobody in those days wore pants, you know.
She was just a little out of her time.
Yeah, she was. Then, of course, when she opened it up for a question and answer, oh, that was delightful. She said, I'm going to tell you. But she said, I think the men are probably going to ask this question. She said, before anybody asks the question, she said, the Chinese women, she said, are just like the Americans. And she moved her hand up and down.
That was beautiful. Everybody just howled.
The men just roared. Now, don't you think that's a sense of humor?
Well, I think it's lovely.
Yeah. Sure it is. Sure. And this woman could give her. Because she said nobody of all the people that she's interviewed said that she had a sense of humor.
Well, may well be that they talked to her later on, and as you say, she developed this dowager empress complex or way of appearing to people.
I don't know where they go. Where they got that, that she had no sense of humor. Because I remember one time she spoke to the Chiropractors Club, and that was before World War II, here in Doylestown, and they came all over the North Atlantic region, from Virginia, Maryland, and everywhere. And she was in green that day. She just like you said, she didn't look like an empress. She stands up there, I don't know how she could stand. And of course, I just I'll show you a little bit of Greer Garson, the movie actress, didn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah, a little bit of Greer Garson in her. And she said, are there any colored American seroptimists? She said, need I ask, do I see any colored American faces? Well, there were one, among a couple hundred of them, you know, the Doyle found in. That's how she got it across in those days, don't you? And to this day, my friend Grace Chan, that meets people, come from North Carolina, came from North Carolina, Virginia, Maryland. The only thing they remember about Doylestown is where Pearl Buck and Sullivan.
Oh boy.
Yeah, see?
Well, maybe they did.
Yeah, they sure did. They sure did. Of course, she said, why don't you have it? You know, they should be voting with you, they should be on the ticket with you, and all that things. I'm off the track, can't forget
about that. That's all right. I was very anxious to ask you about another one of my favorite authors who I had wrote a lot about, who was kind of James Gould Cousins. Did you ever know
him? Oh, now. Got a man.
What's up?
James Cousins. Oh my. See, he lived in Lambertville, you know, on what they call Goat Hill. Yeah. And he lived there until one of the power lines put great big power lines through.
Oh, I didn't know why he lived.
That's right. And then because they spoiled the landscape, they spoiled the rise of glory. And then he sued and he won and he gave that money away.
What's his part?
Oh, I liked him, Jason Cotton. He came to the court. He would come to the courthouse and attend court. That's his recreation. He argued with me. What do you call it? He had no time for the theater. Of course, he was back in the days in the theater when the American theater was still in the folly stages, the scandals and all that business, don't you know what I'm saying? In the day of Scott Fitzgerald and all that business. And those simple or plot and comedy stuff. So he used to say, Lester, this is theater. And I think, you know, in court, where the emotions and the stories they tell, that is theater, don't you know, Steve?
Well, I had always heard that the reason he moved from Lakewood
was
because they ripped down the old Lakewood House. Now you see a change in my home.
Yeah. And he married a Jewess. What was her name? Pauline Baumgartner. And he said to me, if you have any antisemitism, that's what he said to me, antisemitism, he said, the way to get rid of it is to marry one. He said to me how he never saw his father do anything but play tennis. And of course, he wrote By the Possession, which is what I wanted to say.
Oh, is that great?
Thank you.
Yes.
So few people
can think of that. Oh, really?
He was halfway through with that book when he started over. He got off the track somehow. He said to me, Lester, I said, I'll be damned. He said, if I'm not going to have it the way I want it, he started over. Oh, that was back.
You won when it was finished, I guess. But it's such a fun book to be able to, you know, think you're recognizing a different town, his work, even for people, which I know is not so.
And of course, he also called Pearl Buff and Dorothy Parker, and they're not as crazy about the book. You know, he said, "Oh, Lester, you and your bleeding hearts." His idea of a writer, what was the Virginia Woolf? Virginia Woolf. And then another one he liked, what was, is it Doris Lessing? I think she's English. She's very hard to read, I think. I have never read her, but I think she's awfully hard to read. But all these old delightful things. They had a cook that was Catholic, and he had to take her to church very late every morning, you know what I'm saying? So he complained to his wife, and his wife said, "Just take her to church. The damn side easier for you to take her to church than it is for me to get a new cook."
So, that's great.
And he anticipated for we used to get in the jury lounge. We'd meet in the jury lounge of Joe before the court. And you know, like during the intermission, of course, we're at the lawyer's lounge. And this is those young lawyers like Judge Becker. Come in, don't you know? And Judge Becker would say, he said, "Leave me out of this." He said, "I'm not going to get into this." He said, "You two, you can carry on. I won't carry on." But, you know,
well, I didn't realize that he was still around then. I mean, I think that actually he had written his books before Joe died. And I think Paul Becker was involved. Well, you're talking about Paul Becker was a lawyer, not he was a judge.
No, yeah, yes, but he was a lawyer, but he was a very young lawyer and admitted to the bar.
I think when they ripped the old courthouse down, because it was at that time that I know he moved, and that's when this dumb, obviously just over went around, but he was so unhappy that they knocked the courthouse down. But it made a great story.
He moved from here, you know, somewhere down on the eastern shore, and he wrote me once or twice and said that he had the best seafood down there he ever had, but he said also the worst insects. Then from there, he moved to Williamstown, Massachusetts. And he lived there for a while. But he gave me his private telephone number, unlisted telephone number, so if I ever went through there, I was to stop and see. Then I lost track of him. The next, I think he's in Florida now.
Oh, he better
move
back.
I think he's in Florida.
Not
hurry. he was brought up, you know, on Staten Island.
Was he?
He was brought up in Staten Island, and he represented, oh, I hate to say the gentry, but I mean, that's what it was. I mean, nobody in his family ever worked. I don't know, was it Cliff Dupont? Because he said, I never saw my father do anything, but he said, play tennis and drink.
That's sort of one thing.
Yeah. But, oh, I liked him.
Well, I would love to have met him.
Well, you know, he did that, the just and the unjust. See, that was about a murder trial, don't you see?
Yeah.
Well, and then the way he can...
Well, was that or wasn't it about Bulgarov? Was he the hero?
Well, sure, he was in practically a sort of composite. But I thought the most wonderful thing he said about it was, I don't know if you ever knew, did you ever know the old court stenographer, J. Edgar Moore, who took it all down to shorthand?
Right.
Yeah. Great, big, very sober-faced man, don't you know, see? Rest, you know, see, but he had a perfectly deadpan face. But he'd sit there, you know, and see, they don't do that now, you know, they do this. But he was one of the last of the ones to take the note, you know. And it couldn't come too fast. See, he could take it as fast as they could give it to him. And I like what James Cousin always said to him about him. Excuse me, he said he's the only man in the courtroom that had absolutely no feelings either way, in one way or all he cared about was the sound that came.
Maybe he was too busy to be able to get emotional on how to do it.
You know, yes, he could.
Going and going. Oh, right. Well, did you know Martha Mead?
No.
Oh.
No, she's cheap before my time.
Yeah. Well, you were Michener, so there's no...
25.
Yeah.
We graduated in 1925.
And Margaret Michener was... Margaret he was...
Oh, I think about 1917 or 18, I think.
Have you read that book of hers, Black Fury? Is it Black Fury Women?
No.
It's the life?
Yes, I read it. Oh, I like her. I mean, I heard her talk, you know, so often. I think, you know, the things she says, the observations she makes.
Oh, right, but I'm talking about, you know, the early...
No, I
miss
all
she
that.
Was a little girl on the planet.
I know people that went to high school with her, and see, her father, I think, was a professor at Penn.
Yeah,
was that? Well, then they took a house, like, in the winter, here at the corner of that great, you know where John Mason lives in Dorchester, at the corner of West Court? Right across the street. That great big old-fashioned frame house with all of those high gable roofs. That's where Martha Mead lived. And she said, her father practically spent his entire salary trying to buy coal, trying to keep the place warm. I guess he did. With those scenes, don't you know, see?
Well, in the book, she mostly talks about the house in which they lived in Buckingham.
Yes. I know what that is.
But it's really quite fun to know that this many people from the place have sort of an impact upon civilization as we know it has lived in and around here.
And I think Margaret Mead, I guess Margaret Mead and Jim Mishner will just say they are, I think are the most famous high school graduates,
except that they were in Saratoga Springs a couple of years ago and moved up to a painting by Rembrandt Peale. He was born in Northampton.
Oh, yeah, sure.
China.
Yeah.
Mm. I never did that before, and I thought I knew something about history of art. So, you know, there are probably lots more that you don't really realize.
Okay.
I'm from Great Land.
How about Charlie Harkins? Do you know him?
Only a name.
Yeah. Awfully nice person. You know. Who else did you go to high school with or college with that might still be around here and is doing things with the Arts Council in particular, might be interested in? Well, were there ever any musicians of any particular note or ability from Bucks County? I think we seem so much more aware of the painters than the writers.
No, I can't think of it.
And then there have been some really fine sculptors. You know.
Yes.
And Charles Rudy is.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. And Randall Nelson, the one I told you about. Well, you know, used to serve the model.
Oh, did he? No, I didn't.
The picture. Oh, the picture. The sculptor now at the University of Pennsylvania.
Charles Rudy did?
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with
it. Yeah, down there somewhere on the campus or in one of the buildings. That's fine. That was Randall.
Well,
I'll
go look something.
Yeah, you look it up sometime. I don't know just where it is. I have seen pictures of it already. Yeah.
Well, he has a magnificent sort of frieze, only I don't know that you could sort of gaze with the figures in them. Alan Hansford, and there are pretty many figures that make up the total composition.
Now I remember talking about Hansford. I remember when my father and mother took us on a trip. I must have been only about 8 years old, maybe 9 years old, took us on a trip out to Hershey, Harrisburg. I guess that was as far as we went. You'll love this. We got to Coatesville and it was getting dark. We stayed at the hotel in Coatesville overnight. It was too far to drive home. Then it's
well,
in those days, maybe 1915, 1916, that thing. We stayed, I'll never forget. It was the first time that I ever saw colored waiters that had white gloves on when they served.
Oh, wow.
Oh, we thought that was wonderful. Well, what I was going to say about Harrisburg. I remember my mother and father made an issue of it for us, the Mercantiles.
Well, I think it's pretty exciting that they are there.
That many years ago, they came from Doylestown. it didn't mean much to us. We, you know, we didn't know enough about it. But my mom, mother, you know, they indicated the joke. I only have one versatile now. I showed it to Florence when she came to see me when I came from the hospital the other week, and that is a sweet gum leaf. I used to buy the mercantile whenever I got company. You know, I'd get a mercantile as I'm going home here. Or when I go, like away to see some friends of mine as a bread and butter gift, I would send, you know, a tile.
Well, you know.
You send them, you buy them,
you send them all away.
And you can't get them anymore. So I have this one, just one. That's sweet.
Well, there's so many, I mean, there's so many solid reproductions now, which look very likely.
I haven't seen.
Of course, but I don't like it.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that before. But this has all those hues in, you know, the different hues and shadings. The gloss and everything.
Well, I think they're doing an enormously good job.
Exactly.
I have seen that. They're interesting about the old ones. And they just don't have that patina that they get from dust and grime.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's his name? We're awful. All of that. I hated that. County official for a while, remember?
Yes.
Yeah, you know, that's enough. That's enough for me to go.
I think a soul.
All I think now is Rolls Zidell. I'm trying to go to sleep saying Rolls Zidell.
Well, I never saw any of the ones that he was trying to reproduce, if that makes me feel any better. And I think, you know, labor is so much more expensive now, and so naturally the tiles are going to cost more, but they are doing it nicely. And that shop, you would have to stop in sometime and see it. It's very attractive. And I think, you know, like anything else, it probably is helping to keep the lights on and maybe the grass mowed and few things like that. Can you tell where we are at this?
Well, it's been, you know,
terribly kind of
you. Know that, did you ever hear of Miss Dars, Marion Dars? You know, she was an artist, lived here in Doylestown, but her brother, Brower Dars, was the better artist, you know. She lived here in Doylestown, and she did a couple of portraits of the judges, some of the judges.
Oh, really?
Marion Dars, yeah, Marion C. Dars. And then there was a woman that had a funny hand that used to write. And hey, no one was hurt.
Well, Emma Elizabeth Price, you mentioned earlier, and she had a couple of brothers, one